Chapter 4. To Chief of Defense Logistics. From Supreme Commander Galactic Alliance Defense Force. CC, Chief of State, OCGAG, Head of Defense Procurement. RE, Fleet Supply and Procurement Concerns. The shortfall in supplies in theater and the failure of equipment to meet standards are intolerable. You are to give Colonel Solo, OCGAG, every cooperation in resolving this situation as rapidly as possible. This is to be your top priority, and Colonel Solo is authorized to use any means necessary to achieve it. Admiral Cha Neothel, SCGADF. Defense Procurement and Supply Agency, Coruscant.
Are you sure?
Jason had no reason to disbelieve a legal analyst droid. Metal lawyers were even more meticulous than flesh-and-blood ones. HM3 clunked along beside him as they ambled up the apparently interminable corridor to the offices of the head of procurement, explaining the hurriedly assembled data as they went. Jason believed in understanding the enemy, and that meant grinding through the tedium of small print. He was set on taking a lightsaber to a planet-sized ball of red tape.
Yes, sir, this is routine.
HM3 reminded him a little of C-3PO, humanoid in shape, with a necessarily pedantic personality. But he was a sober dark gray, and had a reassuring air of solid professional authority.
A piece of legislation that's overdue for reform. Would you like the full explanation, or a simplified lay-being's version?
Consider me as lay as they come.
As the legislation stands, it takes the agreement of the Defense Council to change the regulations on procurement. It's designed to stop civil servants from bending the rules to line their pockets, or to stop anyone from commissioning an entire army and its accompanying fleet and weapons without the Senate's knowledge, which I do believe happened not so long ago. You might want to look back at the final years of the Republic, sir.
Jason mulled that over and tried to strip it down to basics.
So senators have to vote on what flimsy to purchase and what flavor dry rations to serve to the troops. Monumental waste of time and expense, if you ask me.
I admit it involves top-level decision-makers in very low-level decisions, sir, but it's the law. Every time you want to change something about supplies or any other minor administrative issue, you need Chief Omis or Admiral Neothel or someone else equally senior to rubber stamp it. It's the same for other departments, health, education, all of them.
HM3 seemed apologetic. Jason had little patience with people who found comfort in impenetrable rules and ritual. He wanted things done.
I don't want to take every complaint about hydro spanners and fuel inductors through committees.
How did I ever become the procurement go-to guy? Is Neothel sidelining me? Never mind. I'll learn a lot.
Is there a way around this?
Actually, there is.
Go on.
It's a simple matter of giving appropriate officers of the GA, in the most general sense, the power to change regulations, to remove the requirement for every cough and spit to be dealt with by senators.
How do we do that?
By removing the requirement for approval by Defense Council members. Shall I draft an amendment, sir?
How does that work?
I draft a request for a change in the existing law to relieve regulatory burdens, so that order-making powers can be devolved to appropriate persons, such as senior military officers and ministers of state, without the need to refer the issue to committees, councils, or even the full Senate.
HM3 shuddered. It was a very human touch.
Give them something to debate, and the more trivial it is, the more hours they'll spend on it, because they can grasp the small concepts better, you see.
Yes. But what happens to the amendment? And how long is that going to take?
If I table it today, then it goes before the weekly Policy and Resources Council in 2 days' time, And, as an appropriate person who already has the Chief of State sanction, you can start changing what you need the next day.
Jason clasped his hands behind his back and thought about it. This was making a new law to allow him to change laws. Bizarre.
I wonder how much the Defense Department spends on carpeting, HM3 said peevishly, scanning the floor.
Droids preferred smooth surfaces.
Here's one area where they could economize.
As he walked, Jason was calculating how many simple decisions were mired in approvals. But he had the sensation of someone trying to get his attention. It was wholly in his head. He wondered if it was the voice again, and then realized it was his common sense screaming to be heard. "You're changing laws about changing laws. Think about that." Jason only had a vague idea about what use he might make of that beyond getting supplies moving, but it struck him as a promising area to address.
"What would I be limited to?" he asked.
"Well, there has to be a failsafe in the wording, or you'll never get PNR to agree to it. But if I were to cap the scope of this, say that the existing budget can't be exceeded, then that would satisfy them."
Legislation was terminally boring. No, it should have been. But something in it was forming a hard ball of an idea in Jason's mind.
"Would it be possible to word it so that if I come across any more stupid red tape in the process, I can change that, too, even if I don't know where I'm likely to find it? I don't want some job's worth holding up vital supplies because I didn't specify the right subsection of some obscure regulation."
"That would make it somewhat open-ended."
"But it's just administration. It's not the Constitution or a common charter."
HM3 ground his gears quietly.
"I'll word it generically, so that you can change any administrative procedure you need to. The other failsafe is that only authorized individuals can make use of this, and that can be limited to whomever the Chief of State decides, so there'll be no spending sprees on secret armies, and only a few very visible, accountable people can make use of it. That will reassure the PNR members."
HM3 went silent for a moment, consulting his agenda link.
"I do believe the day after tomorrow is a very, very busy day for PNR, sir. I think the amendment will get through rather more quickly than usual."
It was a good day to bury the Legislative and Regulations Statute Amendment. Jason smiled.
"You'll have to tell me more about how this fits in with the emergency measures legislation that Chief Omis already enacted."
"Full explanation, or—"
"The lay being's executive summary, please."
"The three of you can do anything you need to for the duration of the war. With Admiral Neothel, you are effectively a triumvirate. I have yet to hear Senator Gavli Gassil take note of that, despite his position as head of the Security Council. The Defense Council is simply nodding everything through, when it actually meets, of course."
The thought took Jason aback. He had his own plans for upending the galaxy, but they were large-scale, strategic, and focused on order, justice, and the benign application of military might. The petty minutiae of bureaucracy had never crossed his mind as a weapon in the battle for order. He'd spent 5 years learning the most arcane force techniques in the galaxy, but, again, he didn't have to use a single force skill to gain power this time. It was simply a matter of using psychology to manipulate people around him.
"This is what makes Jedi weaker and lazier. They instantly resort to force techniques without thinking."
HM3 didn't have to remind him to look at the fall of the Republic.
in his desire to understand the environment that had turned his grandfather from Anakin Skywalker into Darth Vader, he'd examined that final decade. Palpatine seemed to have grabbed most of his power by brilliant manipulation and understanding of people's weaknesses, not simply by channeling the power of the dark side. Jason and the droid reached the mighty carved doors of the procurement center. They were almost as fine as the doors to Chief Omis's office. No, they were actually more opulent. Jason turned to his infallible legal advisor.
"Do you think it's wrong that we're effectively a triumvirate, H.M.?" Jason asked. "Undemocratic?"
"I'm not programmed for right and wrong, sir." HM3 sounded a little disappointed, as if Jason hadn't fully understood the complexity of his art. "I can tell you only what's legal and illegal, because they have definitions. Right has no parameters. Justice doesn't either, nor good. Flesh has to make those decisions."
"Flesh makes a different decision on those every day, my friend."
Jason put his hand on the controls, and the splendid relief of an ancient Coruscanti cityscape split into two to admit him into the procurement offices.
"I can change a law to let me change laws. But can I use the law that lets me change laws to change that law itself?"
He thought for a moment that he was enjoying a few childish seconds of playing at circular logic. Then it struck him he'd just had an insight of significant proportions.
"Colonel Solo," said the head of the procurement agency.
Tav Velo was an edgy human male who looked in need of a good meal.
"I've tasked one of my assistants to investigate the shortages. It might simply be a case of delays in the process."
"Is there anyone ahead of the fleet or the GAG in this line?" Jason asked.
"Our suppliers do have other clients."
"I hope they're on our side."
"We source our equipment from allies."
"Are your people moving as fast as they can?"
"Of course they are, Colonel Solo. We're also looking for ways to streamline the process."
Jason smiled.
"So am I."
He looked around the office. It wasn't gold-plated, but he was expecting to see some evidence of lack of frugality.
"Now about the cannon service packs. The parts that need swapping out frequently. I ask for an explanation of why there have been so many misfires."
Velo consulted his datapad with the air of a man with a very good defense, or at least a robust excuse.
"We ran random sampling on those packs yesterday for all the main cannon specs, and the service packs we buy are adequate."
"But we don't want adequate. We want best."
"We do have budget constraints, sir."
"Is this decision made by a department?"
"There's a senior purchasing officer, yes."
Jason knew there was only one way to focus people who didn't quite understand what adequate meant in the field. He turned to the droid.
"H, under the current powers, is there a mechanism by which I can co-opt civilian staff to carry out research?"
HM3 hummed on the threshold of Jason's normal hearing for a few seconds.
"Yes, sir."
"Is there any restriction on location and conditions?"
"No, sir."
"That's what I like to hear."
Jason was starting to enjoy the rich scope for inventiveness that regulations gave him. They didn't limit his options at all. They created new ones. He started to see the joy of the letter of the law.
"I'd like to meet the chief purchasing officer who signed off on the cannon packs."
Velo looked slightly bemused.
"I take responsibility for what my staff do, sir."
"That's very commendable. But I really want to understand the process. And that means getting to know the people. Understanding of the other person's situation is the key to this, I think.
Velo, still looking bewildered, went to summon the purchasing officer via his desk comm.
No, that's quite all right, Jason said. I'll go to his office.
HM3 made an inscrutable clicking sound as the three of them took the turbo lift to the purchasing floor. They stepped out of the cab into an open-plan office that could have accommodated wandering herds without trouble.
Good. Jason wanted an audience. Hearts and minds.
Let me introduce you to Beerus Tay Goff, said Velo. He's our senior purchasing officer for engineering support.
Tay Goff was visibly nervous, and his staff and co-workers, mainly humans, but Nimbanese, Gossams, and Cymerthian too, feigned work while watching discreetly. Jason could feel the pervading anxiety throughout the floor. Goff offered a damp hand for shaking, and Jason turned on his full charm. Tay Goff had a lot of data about why the cannon pack was fit for the job. It was a very good price, he told Jason.
But we have misfires and various problems to iron out, said Jason.
He checked that everyone could hear him, judging their attention by the close-range ripples in the force and their body language.
I'd really like your help on this. I'm asking you to do some evaluation of the cannon pack.
Of course, Colonel Solo. Anything I can do to help.
HM3 leaned in close and whispered to Jason.
Article 5, subsection C-27.
I'm glad to hear that.
Jason smiled at the purchasing officer.
That's why. Under Article 5, subsection C-27 of the Emergency Measures Act, I'm assigning you to the front-line ship that's had the most cannon misfires in the fleet, because there's no better place to gather facts than from the people who have to use this kit, and in the place where they have to use it.
Jason glanced around. Even with force-enhanced hearing, he could detect very little breathing and no swallowing.
I'm more than happy to extend this field deployment to anyone who wants to better understand the end-user's experience of procurement. Just say the word. We're always happy to accommodate you. In fact, I can guarantee you a ringside seat for the action.
Jason smiled with all the diplomatic sweetness he'd learned from his mother and looked around the room, knowing he wouldn't be mown down by volunteers. Tay Goff looked stricken. Jason felt he'd focused everyone on the significance of their job more effectively, and that they now knew what would happen if they thought adequate was good enough.
If you think it's good enough, then it's good enough for you to use personally, on the front line.
HM3 followed Jason out of the building, and they took an air taxi back to the GAG headquarters. It took a little while, because the traffic was heavier than usual, and by the time Jason got back to his office, the arrangements to transfer one civilian, Tay Goff, Beerus J, to the ocean, were already being discussed by GAG personnel. Corporal LeCauf and two of the other 967 commando troopers greeted him like a hero in the briefing room.
"That was a good, clean thing you did there, sir," said one trooper, grinning. "My rifle parts feel more efficient already."
LeCauf gave him a thumbs up.
"Your grandfather would have done the same, sir. Nice move."
In these barracks, that was an honest compliment, and not a warning of the temptations of the dark side. Jason preferred the judgment of ordinary soldiers to the arcane philosophical debate of the Jedi Council.
"It's all going to change. No more wars flaring up in each generation. No more career politicians wringing what they can out of the system. No more talk of freedom that just means a handful can do as they please while the rest struggle for survival. No wonder the old guard feared the Sith, if that was what they threatened. The end of chaos that served only the few. Jason returned the thumbs up to LeCalf.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
HM3 plucked out a datapad. I'll keep you apprised of the progress of the amendment, Colonel Solo. Is that all for today?
I may consult you again. You make all this easier to understand.
That's my job. Jason just wanted to check. He had the germ of an idea.
Funny thing, laws and regulations, aren't they? That amendment gives me, and others, of course, the ability to change the amended law itself, doesn't it? It's quite circular.
HM3 didn't care about right and wrong, just legal and illegal. If Jason had designs on manipulating the amendment for uses beyond speeding up the dispatch of medical supplies, then the droid didn't regard it as part of his remit.
Yes, HM3 said. It is.
Jason tackled the pile of intelligence reports that had stacked up on his desk with renewed enthusiasm. The air was alive with imminence, of things about to happen. The endless thoughts of whom he would have to kill to achieve his sacrifice had gone away for a while, but they'd be back. In the meantime, he had a new tool with which to effect change.
I can change the law that lets me change laws. If I use that wisely, I can bypass the Senate when I need to.
The power of simple human reason was as effective as the Force some days. Tekshar Falls Casino, Kuat City, Kuat.
What happened to the clones? Myrta asked.
Kuat City stank of credits. Fett had never been able to understand how an industrial society, whose wealth was built on heavy engineering, still had an ancient aristocracy.
Funny place. Anachronistic.
Ahead of him, the smarter part of Kuat City glittered. Elegant towers and spires that seemed a refined echo of the industrial skyline of cranes in the orbital shipyards. He knew Kuat well. He'd once saved its shipyards from an attempt to destroy them. He hoped the place was going to show him some gratitude.
"Cannon fodder," he said, answering Myrta at last.
He brought the speeder bike to a halt by an arcade of smart shops.
"They died."
"Not the one I saw. He said some left the army."
"The only way out," said Fett, "was death or desertion."
"None of them retired?"
"Depends what you mean by retired. I heard a few ended up in care homes run by well-meaning peace campaigners, though."
Myrta seemed to be working out what retire meant for men who were trained to kill, who'd been kept apart from regular society, and who had an artificially shortened lifespan. The slight jut of her chin, a sure sign she was annoyed, communicated itself through the helmet. There was only so much she could hide.
"Did you ever hunt deserters?"
"No."
He'd seen plenty, though.
"Didn't pay enough."
"Did you care about them, Babuir?"
"Okay. She finds comfort in playing Mondo. But I'll never get used to that name." "Not really."
"They were your brothers."
"No, they weren't."
He motioned her to get off the speeder.
"Blood isn't everything. You know that's the Mondo way."
"But I bet you'll be shooting that clone a different line," she said. "How else are you going to get him to help you? Beat it out of him? He looks as tough as you are."
"Maybe I'll just ask nicely," said Fett.
Right now, I need to walk into the Tekshar and have a chat with Frigg. That might be a little inconvenient for him.
The Tekshar Falls was one of those feats of architectural near-impossibility at which the Kuati excelled. Other establishments in the galaxy had impressive water features, but the Tekshar was a waterfall, a raging, hammering torrent from a river diverted at vast expense into the entertainment center of the city. It provided its own hydroelectric power, which was just as well given the ferocious array of lights that pierced the curtains of water. The casino was set within the waterfall itself, part construction, part natural stone, with turrets jutting through the water like tree fungi. To get to the entrance, gamblers had to walk through water plummeting 500 meters.
"Pity, I've just had my hair done,"
Myrta said, solidly encased in armor from head to toe.
"Is this how they stop the riffraff from coming in?"
"We are the riffraff," said Fett, "and we're going in."
He paused to hack into the Kuat police database from his HUD system. They wouldn't mind. He was just contributing to law and order around here. Images of scumbags, petty villains, and serious bad boys and girls scrolled down the display inside his helmet. He waited, and shortly Frigg, L, appeared. For gangland vermin, Frigg looked remarkably respectable. Fresh-faced and framed with gold curls that would have made a mother weep. Fett suspected that if Frigg still had a mother, he'd have sold her to a hut by now.
"So you're just going to stroll in?"
said Myrta.
"I only want to ask him a question."
"It's never that easy, is it?"
"We'll see."
Fett strode down the tree-lined boulevard that led to the foot of the falls and forked around it. Only the stupidly wealthy had the time to gamble this early. It said a lot for Frigg's business acumen.
"There's no reason for him to get upset. Just check that your jetpack's primed."
"We might be leaving rapidly, then,"
Myrta said, keeping up with him without apparent effort, a reminder that he was slowing down.
"Will they make a fuss about letting us in dressed like this?"
"It's all about making an entrance."
Fett wiped the windborne spray from his visor.
"People usually find my dress acceptable, sooner or later."
He walked straight across the bridge at the wall of roaring water and churning white foam. The falls parted like a curtain to create a wide portal. Behind, the casino was a vividly lit and completely dry haven.
"Very impressive," said Myrta.
It was a nice trick, played by automated force fields triggered by a motion sensor. But it was, as he often thought, all about presentation. A little theater. It always helped.
"Keep up,"
he said. The lobby of the casino was a study in opulence, as if someone had taken a bet on how many credits they could spend on each square meter. It was everything Fett didn't care for. Flocked wall coverings, gilding, mirrors, and low-level lighting. All the trappings of illusion, and hard to clean, too. The lobby parted into two sections, one leading to the restaurant and the other to the gaming tables. Fett consulted his investment portfolio via his HUD. He noted Tiruwal Construction Holdings.
"Let's not do too much damage," he said. "I think I have shares in this place."
There was a steward at the front desk and a few very large assistants, humans, Trandoshans, and Gran, walking in slow, considered circles around the thick purple carpet that dragged at Fett's boots like tar. He'd never seen a Trandoshan in a formal suit before, and wondered what poor old Bosk would have made of that. It was also unusual to see a Gran in this line of work. It was clear none of them was there to help diners make informed choices from the wine list. The steward was scanning a screen in his desk,
probably matching Fett's image to the database of guests he needed to recognize for one reason or another. Judging by his sudden flinch, he'd found Fett.
"Do you have proof of identity, sir?"
Fett touched his blaster.
"This used to do nicely."
The steward, human, male, utterly ugly, was doing a very good job of not wetting his pants. Fett had to hand it to him.
Haven't seen you here in a long time, sir."
"I've come to visit someone."
Fett indicated Myrta with a thumb gesture.
"With my associate."
"Will that seeing require repairs afterward?"
Fett flicked a very large denomination credit chip onto the desk.
"Keep the change in case it does. Where's Frigg?"
Credits talked. Blasters talked, too, but credits could whisper menacingly every bit as well.
"He's hosting a private sabacc game in his suite on the 30th floor."
"Sir?" The steward smiled valiantly and snapped his fingers at the hired help. "I'll let him know you're on the way up." The nattily attired Trandoshan rushed to his summons, looking like he'd picked the wrong outfit for a costume party.
"Take the, president of Mandalore up to Master Frigg's suite. All drinks on the house."
So they didn't quite grasp what being Mandalore meant. That was okay, because Fett didn't either. Myrta stifled laughter, but only Fett heard it. He switched to the helmet comlink with a blink.
"So do you have shares here, Babuir?"
she said.
"Depending on how many guests Frigg's got, I might need your help. Try not to kill them unless they ask for it."
"Yes, sir, Mr. President."
"I liked you better without a sense of humor."
He didn't dislike Myrta. She'd tried to kill him, but that was a couple of months ago, and things had moved on. She worked hard, and she wasn't mired in fluffy trivia like fashion and holovids. She was strong in every sense. Bevine, and Fett listened to Bevine, said she was a real Mondoad, a solid Mandalorian woman, because she could shoot straight, cook passably well, and had the shoulders of an armor smith. Mondoade valued the frontier kind of female, not decorative trophies who couldn't even dig a defensive entrenchment.
"She's just like Sintas. Not as pretty, but she's so much like her."
He hadn't known Aelin long enough to tell if Myrta took after her mother.
"Sin. I used to call her Sin, and she called me Bo."
Did Myrta have a nickname? What had Sintas told Aelin about him? And what had Aelin told Myrta to breed such hatred toward him? Fett pulled his attention back to the present and followed the Trandoshan, aware of a full 360-degree vista around him, the dulled pain in his guts, and the fact that the closer he got to death, the more he thought about people who hadn't been on his mind in a long, long time. The turbolift doors opened onto a floor of the same thick purple carpet as the lobby, with small salons leading off it. Gaming tables rattled, clicked, and flashed, with lives ruined and fortunes lost. Even through his helmet's filter, he could smell the cloying amalgam of 100 different perfumes distilled from plants facing extinction and parts of animals he didn't even want to think about. The Trandoshan led them along a corridor to an imposing set of gilded doors, then beat a lumbering retreat. The doors parted, and Fett found himself visor to nose with a Hamadryas who didn't seem to know how to blink. Behind him, a group of 6 splendidly dressed gamblers, 3 human males, 2 females, and a weakway, sat around a gilt-framed sabacc table with Frigg. There were 2 more heavies standing by the kitchen doors.
probably on drinks patrol. Master Fat, said Frigg, not looking up from the table. How good to meet you. Frigg had a great hand. Fett could see it embedded in the table's display as he loomed over him. It was a pity to interrupt. His guests were trying to concentrate on the sabacc game, but it was hard to give the cards full attention when there were two bounty hunters paying an unexpected visit. They all found reasons to go to the kitchen to top up their drinks, while the Hamadryas watched silently, one hand now on his holster.
"Got a few questions for you," Fett said. "About your predecessor."
"Depends on what you want to know." Frigg was as well spoken as his hair was coiffed. His gangster dad must have sent him to a very exclusive school. But he hadn't been tutored in the subtle art of putting his hand under the table to check his holdout blaster discreetly. Fett hoped he didn't have to shoot the man before he got some answers. "I do hope you haven't been sent by Cheret's associates to express their displeasure."
"I'm not going to kill you," Fett said. "If I did that, then you wouldn't be able to tell me things. And I want you to tell me things. I'm a curious man."
The Hamadryas on the door already had his blaster visible on his belt, but Myrta had him covered. Fett could see from their HUD comlink connection that she was watching him, the helmet sensors responding to her eye movements. Frigg shrugged.
"What exactly do you want me to tell you?"
"The Mandalorian who killed Cheret. I need to find him."
Frigg had the kind of smile that spread like a crack in ice.
"I've been asked some subtle questions, but that's a good one. I assure you I didn't order Cheret's death."
"I don't care if you sent a wreath and took care of his widow. Do you know where I can find the man who killed him?"
"Shall we step outside onto the balcony?"
Frigg gestured and picked up his drink. "It's a sensitive matter to discuss in front of my guests."
"Suit yourself,"
said Fett, and decided instantly where he was prepared to be maneuvered.
"Step outside. Right."
Myrta stood guard at the open doors, but the Hamadryas bodyguard tried to move her out of the way. He made the mistake of putting his hand on her back, and a little too low at that. She simply raised her clenched fist to shoulder height and ejected her gauntlet vibroblade.
"Touch me again, Chakar, and I'll ram this into your carotid artery."
"I haven't got one."
"Then I'll have to keep stabbing you until I find somewhere else that bleeds copiously."
Frigg intervened.
"Sirku, let's not upset the lady, shall we? Let her wait wherever she wishes."
Frigg was making a lot of mistakes tonight for a crime boss. It was just as well Fett always assumed the worst. Frigg might have thought that a balcony reduced Fett's options, but it didn't represent much of a problem for a man with a jetpack. Frigg didn't have one. He also lacked a fiber cord line. This wouldn't take long.
"Amateurs."
Fett had to fight an urge to explain to Frigg how to do it right. Out on the balcony, Kuat City's lights shimmered through a veil of rushing water in the dusk. An overhang diverted the water a couple of meters from the face of the building. Fett leaned one hand on the rail, feigning casual disinterest, but actually testing the strength of the metal. He cast an eye over Frigg to estimate his weight.
"Let me repeat that simple question. Tell me anything you know about the Mandalorian who whacked your predecessor."
"I had nothing to do with it. Cheret upset a lot of folks. Occupational hazard."
"Question still stands.
I'll bet your organization was keen to find out, too.
We didn't know who he was. All we knew was that he had a grudge about a certain Twi'lek clan. We do business with Twi'leks in the entertainment industry.
I'll bet.
Frage meant Twi'lek girls.
What kind of grudge?
He didn't think we were treating them properly. We lost a couple of very popular entertainers, thanks to him.
Frage was lying scum, and the clone in Mandalorian armor was settling a score for some Twi'leks, but he wasn't a bounty hunter. Another link, then. Personal, not professional.
Time. He didn't have time for this. Seen him since?
No.
Want to tell me who the Twi'leks were?
Why do you want this man so badly? It has to be something big for you to be hunting him.
Frage examined his manicured nails.
Or perhaps some of my associates regret Cherit's passing, so they've hired you to come after me?
Not for hire right now.
Fett could never understand why they didn't listen. They never heard what he said. He played it straight, and they always looked for a second meaning.
I want the Mondo in one piece. I need him to do something for me.
Frage had missed his chance. Fett switched to the helmet comlink and got Myrta's attention, which was fixed on him and the Hamadryas anyway.
I'm just going to help our friend remember a few things. Useful stuff, fiber cord.
Fett shot out the line in a loop from his backpack and whipped it around Frake, jammed the grappling hook between the bars, and shoved him over the railing. It took 2 seconds. Frake screamed, clinging to the top rail, but a good hard whack on the knuckles with the butt of the blaster made the scumbag let go. Frake plummeted, and Fett braced for the inevitable thump into the rail when the rope ran out. It nearly winded him. Frake bounced and twisted in the line's strangling grip, still shrieking. Fett kept a few meters of line secured in reserve in the winch assembly. Myrta was taking good care of the Hamadryas. She'd half-closed the transparasteel doors on him, but the bodyguard wedged his body in the gap and tried to get a blaster shot through the opening. His arm was trapped. Fett watched, impressed, as Myrta headbutted the guard a second time, shoved the vibroblade into his thigh, and forced him, shrieking in pain, nice touch, back through the doors so that they crashed shut. Then she fired a few rounds into the controls.
"Make it quick, Babuir."
She flexed her shoulders as if easing torn neck muscles.
"The doors might be blaster-proof, but they'll get them open sooner or later."
Fett peered over the side. Frage was twisting helplessly like a devi hooked on a fishing line, making gasping sounds. The line was tight around his waist and chest. He was dangling 15 meters below the rail.
"Don't struggle, and think calm thoughts," Fett called. "It helps you remember, and it'll stop you from slipping out of the loop."
"You're crazy. I'll have your throat cut for this."
"You're on the end of a line. I'm on solid ground. Think about it."
"You're a dead man."
"Perceptive to the last. Give me names, vermin."
"I tell you, I didn't pay the Mondo. I'm glad he whacked Cherit, but I never paid him to do it."
"Try again."
Frage's voice was almost drowned out by the roar of the waterfall behind him.
"The Twi'leks were from some family called Hymar."
"Good start."
Fett paid out another meter of line with a jolt. Frage shrieked as he slipped farther toward the permacrete, stone, and raging water 100 meters below.
"Is that helping? Memory often needs a trigger. Hymar."
Any Mondo who pitched in hard to play the hero for a couple of dancers
would be known in the Twi'lek community. It didn't happen that often. Nobody else cared what happened to Twi'lek girls. Fett had his lead. He'd have a contact somewhere. And if he didn't, Bevin would. Bevin wouldn't press him to find out why.
"Anything else you want to get off your chest?"
"I don't know the guy, Fett, but I know you're going to regret this." Fett could hear the dull rhythmic thuds of Frege's bodyguards trying to smash the doors apart.
"If I find you've given me a load of garbage, I'll be back to finish the job."
He braced his boot on the bottom rail and began winching in the gangster. Myrta stood next to him with her blaster trained on the doors.
"You're going soft. Why are you reeling him back in?"
"I want the fiber cord back. It's my favorite ultrafine."
"When you get him on the balcony, I'll tranquilize him."
"Then back to Slave One. Scenic route."
"You're lucky we've got jets."
"I wouldn't have come up here if I hadn't."
Fett felt the sweat breaking out and running down his spine. This would have been an easier task a few years ago.
"And I wouldn't have gone much above 30 floors anyway."
"Why?"
100-meter line. In case I had to rappel down."
Frigg's face was 2 meters away now. He'd stopped yelling and settled for labored breathing.
"I haven't got 100-meter line," Myrta said.
"Lucky you've got jets, then."
He heaved Frege over the rail in a tangled heap, and Myrta delivered a roundhouse punch that laid the man out. If that was her tranquilizer treatment, she was a born medic.
"Time to go."
Myrta shot off at an awkward angle and crashed through the sheet of water ahead of him. There was no force field up here to part the falls. When Fett looked down, he could see speeders crisscrossing the plaza on either side of the boulevard. He needed to land and find the speeder bike. Jets were great for fast exits, but the flame made both of them conspicuous targets in the night sky. The speeder was still where he'd left it, primed with a detonator and hidden in bushes on the edge of a park. Both the painkiller and the adrenaline were wearing off at the same time, and Fett had never been more conscious of the reason for his search. He set off for the landing strip at top speed down freight lanes that had the lightest traffic, noting that Myrta was happily fixing a grenade launcher attachment to her blaster with both hands and gripping the saddle of the speeder with her knees. She looked like she was used to fast getaways.
"You're doing okay for a dead man, Babuir."
"Your dad trained you well, too."
"Most of that I learned from Mama."
"Well, she did a good job of it."
Fett took one hand off the bars and activated Slave One's remote controls. Her drives would be primed. He could drop the speeder into the cargo hold and get off this planet inside a minute. In his HUD display, he was already scanning databases for that Twi'lek family name. This was the one time he felt truly, thrillingly alive, when he was winning, being the best, surviving.
"Is that it? Is that all I can do?"
He almost envied the Bevines and Carids of this world, who delighted in simple things like good food and family. But there was a clean, uncomplicated satisfaction in danger. It erased worries and fears and memories. There was only the moment, and surviving it. Fett concentrated on feeling good and ignoring the pain, right up to the time his rear view caught speeder headlights closing fast, and Myrta turned to level her blaster.
"They must be calling in our course," she said. "You think it's Frege's grunts or security?"
"We won't get the police's attention until you fire that blaster."
His motion sensors showed 2 speeders in pursuit, and 2 coming at them from the right on the crossroads ahead.
Another single speeder was approaching from the left. They might have been ordinary citizens, unlucky enough to be on the same route, or they might have been rushing to intercept him. If he timed it right, he could slip between them and give Myrta a clean shot at the speeders behind. He gunned the drive. Fett counted down the seconds. He was almost at the crossroads, but he wasn't going to make it. From the right, one shot in front of him, and he raised his arm to give it a burst of flamethrower. But the rider suddenly fell sideways and crashed to the ground without a shot being fired. Two speeders heading the other way soared to avoid it. Fett watched the speeder approaching from the left cut across him without even slowing down. He heard a loud crash, but no "bada-p" of a discharging blaster. Had they collided? Had they hit someone who happened to be on the wrong road at the wrong time? Myrta fired a grenade.
"Gotcha!"
A ball of flame lit up the night.
"One down, one to go. Reloading."
"Can't see the third speeder."
"Maybe they crashed."
"We've got a couple of minutes before the police join in,"
Fett said.
"Hey, where did he—"
There was a massive whoop of a white-hot explosion behind them. Fett saw the debris falling hot and red in the rear view of his HUD.
"Good shot."
"Not me. Didn't fire."
"What is this, a crash epidemic?"
"I think we have help."
"I hate help I didn't ask for."
But help it was, so he took the breathing space with grudgingly grateful caution. Maybe their invisible benefactor was saving them for himself. Slave One was standing between two battered freighters, looking nothing special to anyone who didn't know the ship, just an old fire spray idling her drives. Fett grounded the speeder bike and ran for the ship. Who would pick off Frigg's morons for him? Generosity like that came with a price. Fett left Myrta to dock the speeder in the hold and climbed up into the cockpit.
"Come on, girl, what's keeping you?"
He tapped the console switches, and Slave One whined up to full power, a faint tremor passing through her airframe. It said safe. It said home. It was the most reassuring sound he knew.
"You've got 20 seconds before I close the cargo hatch."
There was no answer. And just as that fact registered, Slave One's entry warning light flashed. There was someone else on board. The systems didn't recognize them.
"Myrta? Myrta!"
The internal security cams showed nothing but the speeder. Fett grabbed his blaster and went aft to check. Even through the helmet filter, he could smell a strong, oily stench that he hadn't smelled in years. He couldn't quite place it, but he knew it. The speeder was stowed. The hatch was open. He raised the blaster and wondered whether to just seal the hatch and launch Slave One and hate himself for the rest of his life. What was left of it?
"Dad wouldn't have left you stranded. He'd have risked anything for you."
Fett had abandoned quite a few people over the years. He'd even left Sintas wounded the last time he'd seen her. The very last time. It had seemed the right decision then.
"And you wonder why your daughter and granddaughter tried to kill you."
Fett stood to one side of the hatch. His sensors showed him two shapes on the ramp, one humanoid and one animal whose form wasn't clearly defined. He counted to three and came out, blaster and flamethrower aimed. Myrta, minus helmet, was in the tight headlock of a Mandalorian in gray armor, and a large gold-furred animal had its huge jaws locked around her leg, trailing a curtain of drool. It wasn't attacking. It was frozen, pinning her down, and stinking. And she didn't look scared, just embarrassed. Fett stared down the barrel of a custom Verpine rifle aimed one-handed, and understood why he'd heard no blaster fire when the speeder bikes dropped from the air. Verpines were silent.
Well, well,
said the Mandalorian in gray armor. He really did have a very fine pair of gray leather gloves.
It's little Bubica. Last time we met, my brother was shoving your head down the freshers to teach you some manners. What do you want me for, Mayor Vode?
Galactic Alliance Guard Briefing Room, GAGHQ, Coruscant. Ben was glad to be back among people he trusted. The sea of black uniforms might have been a sinister sight to some people, but to him they felt like a brotherhood, like family. He was in that rare position of being young enough to be treated like one of the troopers despite his officer status, and he liked that. The sense of camaraderie and the knowledge that everyone watched everyone else's back was both comforting and thrilling. He settled into a seat on the end of a row in the briefing room. A trooper called Almack nudged him.
Nice vacation? Glad you could fit us into your busy schedule, sir.
Couldn't wait to get back.
You didn't miss much, Almack said. Been a bit quieter. I think we've broken the back of the Corellian networks.
I always miss the good stuff.
A couple of the other troopers in the row in front turned in their seats and joined in.
We'll find some excitement for you.
Or some filing.
Freshers need a good clean. Here's a toothbrush.
Ben grinned and lobbed a pellet of flimsy at them. It was good to be part of a team. It was good to have friends. They didn't see him as son of Skywalker, Jedi to be feared. He was just Ben, and they looked out for him, as they always seemed to for young officers they liked. And they never asked him where he'd been. Everything was on a need-to-know basis. But the spate of bombings seemed to be over for the time being. It was just a case of working out who to keep an eye on and round up next. Corellians, Bothans, and now Fondorians. Captain Lon Chevu strode onto the dais at the front of the room, looking as committed as ever. But Ben felt the reluctance and misgivings in him. He could sense it in a few of the other troopers, too, generally the ones who'd been in the CSF. Jason followed Chevu and got instant, undivided attention. Jason could do that. Ben wasn't sure if he envied him or not. It was interesting that he seemed to enjoy being the focus for ordinary beings, but chose to hide himself from Force-sensitives. It was as if he only wanted to be seen by the mundane world.
I have to learn how to do that. Mom says I did it as a little kid, but that was by instinct, like babies swimming. I want to learn how to do it like Jason does.
Brief for the next 48 hours, ladies and gentlemen, said Jason. We're moving into a different phase. The priority now is to look for professionals, Confederation intelligence agents. Now, normally, we'd leave that to our colleagues in Alliance Intel. But seeing as we've got all their best operatives...
Applause and laughter interrupted him. He paused with a big grin and picked up again.
Seeing as we got the pick of the litter, we'll be helping them out. We'll also be providing close protection for Chief Omis and key ministers to relieve CSF and monitoring for them. Results of interrogation suggest we might be looking at more targeted and professional assassination attempts, as in government agents, not just disgruntled amateurs and bounty hunters.
A hand was raised at the front. Ben couldn't see who it was.
What's monitoring in this context, sir?
Jason flashed a holo image onto the screen behind him. It showed a diagram of the various routes by which GA ministers could be reached, physically or virtually. Offices, home addresses, private clubs, routes to the Senate, comlinks.
Like this, he said.
Are we allowed to tap senators' comlinks, sir? Asked Chevu.
Under the Emergency Measures Act, we are authorized to carry out any surveillance to prevent acts of violence against ministers of state and visiting allies.
Chevu's face was unreadable, but Ben felt the sharp unhappiness in him. Now there was a guy who knew how to conceal what he was thinking. Ben wondered if that was a more useful skill than hiding in the force. Tapping Senator's comlinks didn't seem to bother anyone else at the briefing. Ben couldn't see the problem either. It made sense, for their own protection. Jason tasked squads to their roles, and there was discussion about supplies.
"Draw up a wish list," Jason said, beaming. "I think we've eased the supply situation, or we will have by the end of this week."
There was a ripple of laughter.
"Did you persuade them to see things your way, sir?"
"Oh, I just made sure the flimsy was in order."
There was more laughter and a ripple of applause. For a moment, Ben felt a conspiratorial closeness between Jason and the troopers. It was genuine. Jason wasn't doing his charisma act to persuade people to do what he wanted, although he was very good at that. He enjoyed the company of his troops, and they enjoyed his. There was a sense of shared danger, and that the rest of the world wasn't part of all this. Ben took mental notes about the art of effortless leadership. The briefing broke up. Ben hung back to talk to Jason, getting a few joking comments about his recent absence as the troopers filed out, and giving as good as he got. He felt a sudden pressure at the back of his head, and when he looked around, Jason was watching him from the side of the dais, smiling slightly.
"They like you," he said. "That's good for an officer, as long as you're liked for the right reasons."
"Isn't it important to be respected instead?"
"What's respect, Ben?"
Ben pondered the question, hearing a subtle test in it.
"Thinking that a person does something right, and that they do it better than you, and so you feel positive toward them."
"Excellent."
"That's not the same as being liked, though, is it?"
"Not at all. We can respect those we dislike," Jason said. "The way to be liked by your men is this, that they believe that you would never spend their lives cheaply, that their welfare comes first, and that you wouldn't ask them to do anything that you wouldn't do yourself, to share their trials and triumphs without being one of them. And they know that's how it has to be, because they know an officer has to make decisions that cost lives, and that's something you can only do if you remain sufficiently separate."
Ben hadn't lost a trooper from 967 Commando yet. In fact, they'd had no fatalities or even serious injuries. They led charmed lives as far as the rest of the military were concerned. He had no idea how he'd feel if he had to put them in a position where deaths were inevitable. Jason seemed to read his mind again.
"Until you can make those decisions, you're not safe to lead."
"But it's easier if you're prepared to die yourself, right?"
Ben suddenly felt much better about Lumia's attempt on his life. He knew it was her now, piecing together what had happened on Zeost and what Mom had told him. But it was okay. He could look all the 967 in the eye now.
"Because if you're willing to make the same sacrifice, that's the one thing that matters."
Jason leaned close to him.
"It inspires. It's the ultimate act of honesty with your troops."
Ben knew that was how Jason led, and why everyone was so loyal to him. He led from the front, and he loved being in the thick of the fighting. The fact that as a Jedi he had survival advantages they didn't have rarely seemed to cross their minds.
"I don't know which way I'll jump when the time comes," Ben said. "Nobody does. But I'll try to do what's right for the majority."
Jason's smile was utterly luminous for a moment.
but then it faded as if he'd recalled something awful. His force presence vanished for a few seconds, and then returned. That was weird, Ben thought. Jason was standing right next to him. So what was he hiding from? "Can you teach me to do that?" Ben asked. "Hide in the force?" Jason seemed shaken. "Why?" "Because Lumia is trying to kill me. I thought it might come in handy." "And for avoiding Mom and Dad sometimes." "Yes, it would be handy. Mom says she's got evidence that I killed... that Lumia thinks I killed her daughter. I don't remember a thing about what happened on that asteroid, Jason, but maybe it doesn't matter, because Lumia believes it. And I bet she was behind what happened on Zeost." Jason's face was carefully blank. Ben couldn't tell what he was thinking now, not even from the Force. "Yes. Why not?" Jason said. His voice was softer, almost hesitant. "Don't you worry about Lumia. She's not up to killing you."
"When can we start?"
"It's very simple."
"Yeah,"
Ben said dubiously. "No, it is. The principle is simple. It's the practice that's hard. It might take you years to master it." Jason motioned him to sit down on the floor. "Come on. Meditation position." Ben sat down cross-legged and closed his eyes automatically, taking deeper and slower breaths until he reached the stage where the world beyond him seemed distant and he was hyper-aware of his own body, even the movement of blood in his veins. Jason's voice seemed to be coming from another time and place. "You're contained. The world can't touch you."
"Yes."
"Now break the shell. Break the container." Jason's tone was even and soothing. "See the world in its component atoms. See yourself as atoms too. Find the line where you end, and the world begins." Ben visualized the room around him and the air in it. It became a frozen snowfall of varying density, some particles clustered, some scattered. Then he looked into himself and saw the microscopic unevenness of the surface of his skin, and the overlapping plates of keratin in his hair, and then beyond that to where he was just like the room around him, a snowstorm of molecules. Some of the room was within him as oxygen and dust, and some of him was in the room as fragments of skin and droplets of water. There was no line. There was no edge that divided Ben Skywalker from the room, or from Coruscant, or from the galaxy. He merged with it all, and it merged with him. There was nothing solid. Just a warm, drifting sea of molecules, some of which assembled loosely and long enough to be Ben Skywalker. "So you can do it." Jason's voice drifted from a long way away. Ben suddenly felt as if he were dissolving and would never be whole again. Panic gripped him. He jerked his eyes open with a massive effort like tearing open a rock with his bare hands, an effort so immense that he found himself gasping for air.
"Oh, wow!"
"Now," Jason said softly, "you see why practice is necessary. But full marks for technique."
"How does that hide me?"
"You blend with the universe. Think of it as force camouflage. The trick is to become so comfortable with it that you can slip into this state of being dissolved, yet still carry on functioning, fully aware." Ben couldn't even manage another wow. He was absolutely determined to master the technique.
and at the same time scared by it, because it felt like a seductive, comfortable death. He was afraid he might sink so deeply into it that he'd never get out again. It was as close as he'd ever come to both knowing and feeling what the Force was. He felt he'd never be the same again, or see the world in quite the same way.
Wow!
If only all his Force knowledge had manifested itself that fast and that vividly.
You need to practice regularly, said Jason.
Ben nodded, worried about looking too enthusiastic. It was more than just a useful way to evade his father now. It was worth pursuing in its own right, for the sheer sensation of it.
I will, he said.
The moment of ecstatic revelation had passed, and he felt oddly chilled.
Any orders for me? Or am I just going to be listening to comlinks now?
Oh, I have a mission for you.
Like the amulet?
Maybe he shouldn't have said it, but he felt bad about the whole thing, as if it had been not only a waste of a man's life, but also nowhere near as important as he'd been led to believe. He hated being humored.
I can handle the truth, Jason. You'd be surprised.
Jason was all serene composure.
I've got a job that only you can do, and it's critical. You might not want to accept the mission.
If it's an order, it's an order.
Better hear it first.
Jason reached into his jacket and pulled out a datapad.
Read this. It's the original sources of the intelligence I received. So you can judge for yourself.
Ben took the datapad and studied the screen. There were transcripts of comlink conversations, and even grainy images of a meeting taken from such an odd angle that it must have been captured by a spy droid in a very awkward location, probably on the top of a cupboard. Men in expensive suits and tunics, sipping caff and talking in hushed tones. A man with well-cut dark hair, younger than Jason. Ben recognized him as Der Gedgen.
That's the Corellian Prime Minister, he said.
That's all intel gathered from our contacts inside the Corellian government offices. Read on.
There was discussion of driving a wedge between Hapes and the Galactic Alliance. It sounded like the usual political maneuvering that always bored Ben, until he started to read recurring phrases like Queen Mother and seeing the disadvantages of siding with the Alliance. And then there were references to removing obstacles. It all fell into place when he flicked to the next holoimage and saw discussion of appropriate bounty hunters who might be willing to operate in the Hapen Royal House. Ben might have been bored by politics, but he understood better than he imagined, and he knew that he had to if he wanted to survive.
This is about Tenel Ka.
Correct.
Gedgen really did plan the attack on her then.
Correct. We finally have hard evidence. And so we can act.
Ben should have felt outrage, he knew, but what filled him then was despair that people found it so easy and so necessary to plot to kill each other. It was happening to his own family and to him, and it was happening between heads of state. They were all crazy. They'd lost all reason. Or was this the way the adult world really worked? Doing all the stupid, cruel, destructive, impulsive things that they swore they'd grown out of.
What do you want me to do?
Ben asked, pretty sure what the answer would be.
Assassinate Gedgen.
Jason rubbed his forehead wearily.
He's a piece of work, and he'll destabilize our allies.
There's no negotiating with a man who routinely resorts to state-sponsored assassination like that. The Corellians need to know we can reach out and take them, too. Sober them up a bit. Way too cocky.
Isn't that what we're doing, though? How is our assassination different from theirs? Won't it just lead to more killings?
You want to do this by the book? Okay. Call Corellian security and report Gedgen for conspiracy to murder. Oh, and for having Thrak and Sal Solo assassinated, too. Even though we can't call my father in court to testify to that. Let's see how fast they arrest him.
I know...
You don't have to do it.
Jason had that slightly wounded tone that said quite the opposite.
But you proved you were competent at covert ops when we hit Centerpoint. And you can get close to Gedgen a lot more easily than some big hairy commando like Duville. You can look like a harmless teenager.
I am a teenager, and I'm usually pretty harmless. But Jason had a point. If anyone was going to do it, and the fact that Jason had mentioned it meant he'd already made up his mind, then Ben had the best chance of getting close enough to Gedgen without being spotted. Jason stared at him, head slightly on one side, with that almost smile that said he was sure Ben was going to say yes.
I can't exactly ask Boba Fett to do this, can I? Jason said quietly.
They're taking bets on how and when he's going to try to kill you. An officer shouldn't ask his troops to do anything he wouldn't do himself. I can't leave this to one of the 967. Okay. I agree Gedgen's rotten to the core. And once we can go public on this stuff, then the warrant on Uncle Han and Aunt Leia is dropped. Right?
I can't, Ben.
Jason sighed.
Everyone knows they had nothing to do with the attack, but they're still working for Corellia, and I can't suspend arrest warrants just because they're family. That's how corruption starts. Besides, what example does that set the troops? Will they ever trust us again if officers bend the rules for family?
Ben was reminded once more that he didn't take after his father, who would have insisted on arresting Gedgen. It was dirty work, but he should have realized that by now. He couldn't hand it on to someone else if he wanted to think of himself as a man, or an officer.
"I'll send you with good backup," Jason said. "Shevu and LeCauf. Our contacts on Corellia are working out a time and place. You'll have to be ready to go at a moment's notice."
Ben wondered how he was meant to kill Gedgen. It seemed a sacrilege to use a lightsaber. He concentrated on the practicalities and logistics, pondering briefly on where the hit would take place, how close he could get, and what would work best, blaster, projectile, or something more exotic. There was his mother's vibroblade, but Ben wasn't sure he had the stomach to use it in cold blood. He only knew how to defend himself and others, not how to hunt for the sole purpose of killing.
"You can do it," said Jason, who always seemed to know his thoughts. "Same techniques you use already, just a different mindset. Go talk to the sniper team."
The best person he could have consulted on the finer points of assassination was his mother, once the Emperor's hands, the best assassin of her day. "Hey, Mom, is a headshot best? Double tap or triple? Do you think a silenced blaster is a better option than a lightsaber?"
Ben knew that was a conversation he could never have.
Jason watched Ben leave the briefing room and took a deep breath. It was all he could do to keep the breath steady and not let it become a sob.
"I can't do this.
I can't kill him.
If the Force had made things clearer, explained explicitly what he had to do, go here, kill this, recite that, then it might have been easier. It was not knowing that was unbearable. Not knowing if he was reading too much into the uncertain interpretations of knotted tassels, into Lumia's vague pronouncements, into parallels with his grandfather that might not even have been there. He knew his destiny was to be a Sith Lord more surely than he knew anything, but it was this final test that left him in agonized turmoil. What if I'm wrong? What if Lumia's wrong? What if I don't have to kill anyone at all, and I kill Ben because I couldn't translate a stupid prophecy straight? The prophecy said, he will immortalize his love. It said a lot of other things, too, like he'd make a pet. He still didn't have anything fluffy, scaly, or feathered to his name, and it was stretching it to apply that to the faithful Corporal LeCouf, who served him as selflessly as his grandfather had served Vader. Immortalize doesn't have to mean kill. But he had no idea what else it might mean. This was the worst thing about Sith teaching. There weren't just two possible interpretations of anything, but three, four, five.
So only the Sith deal in absolutes, do they, Obi-Wan? You told Vader that, or so Lumia says. You liar. The Sith deal in anything but absolutes, because life itself was like that. A million choices to be freely made, all of them to be lived with, and requiring the courage of conviction. Just a clue. How will I know? What will the sign be?
Lumia didn't know either. Or if she did, he wasn't going to listen. Enough games. Enough guessing. This all rested on his judgment.
I'm looking for signs and portents like a Rin fortune teller. It has to be more rational than this.
It was. Ben's comment from the conversation they'd only just finished leapt into his mind.
An officer has to make decisions that cost lives.
It was for the good of the majority, he said.
And if Ben could think it, then Jason had to as well.
He thought it, activated the security locks on the briefing room doors, sat down in a corner with his head resting on his knees. When he put his hand to his face, he found it wet with tears.